Please, Lord.
Let me find out where we are. Okay, I think we were talking about Diocletian. Is that true? He's the worst persecutor and the last one. I know, one time I remember I was having this real wonderful experience. I'd been praying with this group of people for about 3 hours, and we were just soaring in the Spirit, and I had to quit and come teach Bible college, and I didn't want to quit, but I had to quit at 9 o'clock, and so I came to class, and I had to teach on the Battle of Armageddon. And I came into class, and I looked at my notes, and I said, I don't even want to teach on the Battle of Armageddon. I'm not even going to be here. And that's how I felt. I felt like, let them fight the Battle of Armageddon. I don't want to be involved in it. The last one is the worst one. And this, of course, is a type of the persecutions of the church. Because to our knowledge, the last persecution of the church will be the worst one. Now, who will that be under? The Antichrist. Now, you might say that at the end of the millennium, there is that little season where Satan comes out and they make war against the saints. That might be a time of persecution, but probably not. I think the last one is the worst one under the Antichrist, just like it is here with Diocletian. So Diocletian concluded that his plan had succeeded. You remember he passed a number of edicts, first, second, third, and fourth, and then I gave you some examples of the severity of persecution. Finally, he concluded his plan had succeeded, and pillars were raised, and medals were struck to commemorate the victory of exterminating the Christians. But the God in heaven saw this, and so calamities started in the empire. Diocletian eventually quit as emperor and committed suicide. Great and important changes began to take place in the sovereignty of the empire, but the head of the church was watching over everything. Jesus had limited and defined the period of his people's sufferings, and the hosts of hell could not extend it even 1 hour beyond what he allows. God appeared to be making requisition, blood for blood. Galerius, who most feel was the real author of this persecution under Diocletian, you remember he's his son-in-law and he was prevailing upon Diocletian to persecute the Christians, fell sick with a loathsome malady. Like Herod the Great and Philip of Spain, historians say, quote, he was eaten of worms, close quote. Now, this is a polite way of describing a venereal disease. Eaten of worms. Physicians were sought for, oracles were consulted, but in vain. Every remedy applied to Galerius only aggravated the disease. The whole palace was aggravated by his affliction, and he eventually was deserted by all of his friends. These agonies he was suffering forced him to cry for mercy, and eventually he even put out letters asking Christians through the empire to supplicate God on his behalf. Now, the interesting thing is, they just struck medals commemorating the extermination of Christianity. And so here's Galerius saying, Christians, pray for me. Well, the Christians were supposed to be gone. And yet, they knew they weren't. They knew they were there. From his dying bed, Galerius issued an edict, which, while it condescended to apologize for past severities against Christians, under the false plea of regard for public welfare and unity of Rome, admitted to the full extent the total failure of the severe measures for the suppression of Christianity. It also provided for the free public exercise of the Christian religion. And this is known as the Edict of Toleration, passed in A.D. 311. A.D. 311. For about a few days after the promulgation of this edict, Galerius died. And for about 6 months, the merciful orders of this edict were acted upon, and great numbers of Christians were liberated from prisons and mines where they had been working as slaves. But many bore the marks of bodily torture, only short of death. Throngs collected to assemble in the city of Rome and other places to worship Christ. And heathens were astonished that there were so many Christians. Many accepted Christ and claimed the Christian God was the true God. They came out of the mines, they came out of homes, they came out of other places, prisons. And those who were faithful were given praise and privileges as Christian leaders. Those who were unfaithful in the time of persecution openly confessed their faith in Christ, and they wept and repented and asked mercy of God and their brothers. Christians made their way homes. Some of them had been exiled to France and other places from Italy. And so All through the empire, starting in 311, there were bands of Christians traveling back and forth, north and south and east and west, going home after having been exiled and deported. Historians say there were mobs of them praising God with jubilation and singing and their faces shining. And they'd walk through cities praising God and singing. But it only lasted for 6 months. Those who failed and repented, during the 6 months, they said they were sorry, they recanted, they said they would stand for Christ. And so God allowed the persecution to revive one last time to test those to see if they would really stand like they said they would. What happened was, there was a persecution under this emperor on file 52, page 5, Maximinus. You'll see him down a ways from Diocletian. Maximinus. He persecuted the church for 1.5 years until 313. And so there was a revival of persecution, briefly, under him. He's not one of the main persecutors. Maximinus, who succeeded Galerius in the government of Asia, sought to revive the pagan religion in all of its original splendor. He also sought to suppress Christianity with relentless cruelty. He commanded that all the officers of his government, from the highest to the lowest, both in civil and military service, and that all free men and women, all slaves, even little children, should sacrifice heathen sacrifices to Rome and the Roman gods, and even partake and eat the food offered to heathen gods at their altars. He also proclaimed that all vegetables and meat in the marketplace were to be sprinkled with holy water or with wine that was used in heathen temples in their sacrificial offerings, and so Christians might be forced to partake of at least some form of contact with idolatrous worship. So you have this persecution starting again late. New tortures were invented, and fresh streams of Christian blood flowed in all the provinces of the Roman Empire, with the exception of France. But again, the hand of the Lord was heavy against the empire and the emperor, and calamities broke out in his section of Asia. There was tyranny, war, pestilence, and famine. It almost depopulated certain provinces of Asia. Throughout the dominions of Maximinus, there was no rain for 4 months all summer. A famine desolated the whole East. Many rich families were reduced to beggary. Some even had to sell their children as slaves. And the famine produced the usual accompaniment, pestilence. Boils broke out all over the bodies of people who were seized with this sickness, especially around their eyes, so multitudes of people became helplessly and incurably blind. All hearts failed, and all who were able fled from these infected houses, so people were left to die in a state of absolute desertion and perish alone in their homes. Christians who were moved by the love of God, however, came forward to do the kind work of humanity and mercy. They nursed the people, attending the living, and they decently buried the dead. And so you see the work of the church here to give mercy to those who even hated them. Maximinus was alarmed, though, over all of these calamities, and when it was too late, he tried to retrace his steps. He issued an edict avowing toleration of all religions, and he commanded the suspension of all violent measures against Christians, and recommended only mild, persuasive means to win back people to the false Roman religions. He eventually was defeated in a battle by Licinius. You'll see him right above Maximinus on this chart. And having been defeated, he turned his rage against pagan priests who had promised him victory. He charged them with having deceived him with false hopes of victory over Licinius and of the reigning universally over the whole empire. And he revenged his disappointment by a promiscuous massacre of all the pagan priests within his whole empire. His last imperial act was the promulgation of another edict, still more favorable to the Christians, in which he proclaimed unrestricted liberty of religious conscience. conscience, and he restored all confiscated property of their churches. But finally he died, closing the persecution of the church. Many names of great celebrity for station and character were among the martyrs of this period. Thousands of people died under Maximinus. So we would summarize this by saying the persecutions got worse as you progress. The last and worst one is Diocletian, but you do have this short outbreak under Maximinus to test those who professed faith in Christ after Diocletian's Edict of Toleration. Let me give you a famous quotation in church history. It comes from Tertullian, T-E-R-T-U-L-L-I-A-N. Tertullian said this, quote, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church," close quote. He's a Roman church father, about 160 to 220. And he said, "The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church." One of the most famous quotations in church history. And what he means is, just like you take a seed and you put it in the ground and something larger grows from it, so he says, when you kill a Christian and you spill his blood, his blood soaking into the ground is like a seed that springs up other Christians. That's what he means. So people get saved seeing the testimony of Christian martyrs. Maximinus, by the way, died by poison. His empire was in shambles. Christians were dead. His own heathen priests were dead. Multitudes of his subjects were dead in Asia. There was diseased and poor. Poverty all over the nation. God reduced them in payment and retribution for killing his people.
Do you think that these heathen priests were there being demonically driven to motivate these kings in a lot of cases, promising them victory and promising them, you know, prosperity if they would persecute Christianity?
I haven't read examples where the heathen priests were really pushing persecution. I suppose some of them did. I don't know that factually, though. Finally, there was the Edict of Milan, M-I-L-A-N, the Edict of Milan. This is issued in 313 by Constantine, and it is the complete ending of persecution in the church. The Edict of Milan by Constantine in 313. Now, what I want to do is talk about the Roman emperors themselves and just some things about Rome in general and persecution in general. The first thing I want to talk about is this. Would you agree to call Caesar Lord, quote unquote, Lord, if you were faced with the question, call him Lord or die? How many vote you could call him Lord? Raise your hand. They said, you call him Lord or we'll kill you. Raise your hand if you would call him Lord. Huh? All of a sudden we're wondering, Sarah called Abraham Lord. Let's see. That's a scripture, you know. So would you do it or not? How many of you would do it?
I think we are, as long as you didn't worship him.
Okay, call him Lord, but you mean Lord in the sense of master. He's the king, and Peter said, fear God and honor the king. Okay, so how many would do it? Okay, how many wouldn't do it? Okay, well, we have a disagreement. Now, that's what they had in the early church. They weren't sure what to do with this thing. The church decided during times of persecution it was wrong to call Caesar Lord. And the reason is, and I didn't tell you this, of course, so there's no way you could know yet, they meant Lord in the sense of deity. When they said Lord, they meant God. And of course it would be wrong to call him God in any sense. And this is what this consists of. To make a Christian call him Lord was the Roman way of acknowledging him as God. Because to a Christian, Jesus Christ is Lord. Philippians 2:11. Philippians 2:11 says, "And that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." Now there are other passages which teach this same thing. Romans 10:9, Romans 14:11. You see, the early Christians viewed the Greek word kurios, K-U-R-I-U-S, Lord, as the equivalent of the Hebrew term Yahweh, or the name of God. Because in the Old Testament, the passages which say Yahweh of hosts are quoted that says Kurios of hosts in the New Testament. And so Kurios was the equivalent word for Yahweh, or God. And so to call him Lord was to say he's taking the place of Jesus Christ. He is God on the earth. And they couldn't do it. They didn't do it. They agreed it was wrong to do. To call Caesar Kurios was to call him Yahweh, the true God. For example, it's used in this sense in James 5:4. There are a lot of scriptures where people called Jesus Lord, like John 20:28, when Thomas joins it with the absolute title of deity, saying, "My Lord and my God." And the lower meaning of Lord, Kurios or Lord, can mean master. It can mean you're a slave and he's your owner and he's your boss. And of course, a Christian could do that, you know. He could say, "You are Lord in the sense of being the human king, and we give you honor due to the human king." But it would be wrong to do it simply because that it is what they mean by it, and they're making you deny Christ by it. In that case, it would be wrong to do. These Roman emperors, too, they were very insecure. And the reason is, they were subject to death constantly. If you look at this list, you'll notice a lot of them didn't reign very long. Let me give you some examples. In the history, the outline of history written by H.G. Wells, listen to this comment about these Caesars. Quote, it's one of the best written pieces of literature I've ever found. It says this, quote, "These various Caesars and their successors and their womenkind were probably no worse, essentially, than most weak and passionate human beings. They had no real religion, being themselves gods. They had no wide knowledge on which to build high ambitions. Their women were fierce and often illiterate, and they were under no restraints of law or custom. They were surrounded by creatures ready to stimulate their slightest wishes and to translate their vaguest impulses into action. What are mere passing black thoughts and angry impulses with most of us became therefore deeds with them." Close quote. Now think about that. You know, the devil comes to us and he gives these passing black thoughts. And of course, we never would do any of that stuff, you know. But he comes to you and puts things in your mind. Not to them, though. Because they had unlimited wealth, unlimited power, and they're surrounded by creatures who are, quote, "ready to stimulate their slightest wishes and translate their vaguest impulses into action. So what are mere passing black thoughts with most of us became therefore deeds with them." And that's the truth. They were wicked beyond belief. Emperor Commodus, for example, declared himself the Roman Hercules. And he worked out until he was a muscular man. And he showed his skill in the arena fighting lions. But he had extra guards and the lions were drugged. And so he took precautions to protect himself, but he wanted to be a big hero in front of everyone. He entered the arena as a gladiator, fought with a helmet and a sword and a buckler against a gladiator with a net and a trident 735 times and won, killing his opponent every time. Now, this is murder, you know, really. And these events were recorded and acclaimed. But the population began to be ashamed of him because the gladiator was the lowest form of entertainment at that time. People went, but a gladiator was usually a slave or a Christian or a criminal. And so for him to go down and fight as a gladiator, it's kind of like that Saturday night cheap wrestling, you know, where they have that bad wrestling. What do they call it? It's just big time wrestling, you know, where those guys fake it all. That's what this is like to them. It was looked down upon, like, oh, brother, you know. It'd be like President Reagan coming out, you know, with pink shorts and pink hair, and he says, pretty Pat Pattison, you know, and he's going to wrestle the big boomer, whatever these guys are called, you know. It's like that. And so here you have the emperor down doing this, and people didn't like it at all. He also sang and danced and mimicked and clowned publicly. He was licentious to the extreme with women. He killed many senators who were under suspicion. Other people were afraid of him. He died a horrible death. What happened was, he'd been out hunting, and he came in, and he got drunk. And he was laying in his bedroom with his favorite concubine, Marcia, drunk, totally exhausted from hunting. And she fed him a glass of poison. He drank the poison, choked, realizing he was poisoned, and she hid 5 wrestlers behind a curtain in his bedroom. And as soon as he choked, 5 wrestlers jumped out and jumped upon him and strangled him to death. Now, what a way to go, you know. Imagine dying that way. What a horrible way to die. You go, you realize you're poisoned, and then these big guys jump out and strangle you to death. Yuck. After he died in 192, I'm just going to give you a few examples of things that happened to him so you get the flavor of how insecure you'd be in that job. After he died, the Praetorian Guards auctioned the emperor's seat. Now, these are the top guards of the empire, and they are ruling in the palace. And many people bid on the job. Historians say there was an old man named Julius. He was balding with a pot belly, and his wife goaded him to buy it. And his daughter goaded him to buy it. They say he didn't want it. He was rich, a real old senator, kind of fat, you know. And so here he is, you know, his wife saying, buy it, buy it. You can be the emperor. You know, can't you just picture how this is? And he says, oh, I don't want to be the emperor. I'm happy, you know. She says, no, we can rule Rome. So she prevailed upon him. He paid every guard 15 years' wages, and he bought it. Now, this is an incredible amount of money. If you figure a guard makes the equivalent today of, like, say, $10,000 a year, 15 years is $150,000. If he made $20,000 a year, that would be $300,000 per person. Paid them all off, and of course, he had the highest bid, so he won. He became the emperor, but he was despised because he wasn't a military hero, and he was fat and old and balding and didn't have any friends. Now, at this time, there was this general, Septimius Severus. Now, if you look on your list, we're in about 193 here, okay? See this Didius Julianus? That's the guy I'm talking about. Notice Commodus, he dies in 192. There's a story on Pertinax, but I'm not going to tell it to you. Didius Julianus is the guy we're talking about. Notice how long he reigned. See him on the list? He got several of them in a row. Here's what happened. He reigned less than a year. Septimius Severus was the great general of the Roman army, and he was in North Africa. And he heard that Commodus had been killed, and that this Julianus guy took over, or Julius, and he didn't like that at all. And so he gathered all the Roman armies from the southern part of the empire, and he began to march on Rome. And he sent riders on horses into the city over and over again, daily, saying that he was on his way, and Julius would die when he arrived. Now, as he came, Julius began to tremble at every message of his nearing approach. And as Severus came closer to Rome, moving north, cities opened their gates and they cheered this great military hero. And more men joined the army, and the army got bigger and bigger and bigger the closer they got to Rome. The fleet joined him, and so there were sailing ships sailing up the coast while the army was marching up the coast, increasing in size. When he got within 250 miles of Rome, Julius was beside himself with fear. Now, all of a sudden, it wasn't such a great idea, you know, to be emperor. But there he's too late. He implored the faith of these praetorians to stay with him. He put out all kinds of money to build special defenses. He fortified his palace. But the soldiers had quit working because they'd been paid all this exorbitant money. And so they'd laid aside their armor and they'd been playing around and spending their money on wine, women, and song. They were unpracticed, not used to their armor, and so he had to retrain them. And the historians say that they got on the elephants and they threw them off, and some of them were weak now and they weren't ready. And they declared that Severus was a public enemy, and so his own army began to defect from him. He sent messengers out to negotiate with Severus, and they never returned. So he sent other ones out to negotiate, and they didn't return. He sent assassins out to kill Severus, and they never returned. Finally, he ordered a group of Roman priests and Vestal virgins to go out with religious trappings and offer religious sacrifices to Severus if he would stay a general. Severus was unaffected by this whole thing. He was just going to march in and take over, and that was it. He had the army on his side. He kept himself surrounded by 600 chosen men 24 hours a day against any secret conspiracy. He wanted to ascend to the throne without any bloodshed. He wanted to march into Rome and have the army cheer him and just have one man killed, Julius. Julius finally sent troops out to fight Severus. When they arrived and saw the huge army, they defected and joined Severus' army. Everything was turning against this poor man, Julius. The army was enlarged. Finally, his emissaries in the capital promised the praetorians, we won't punish you for selling the throne. Severus sent emissaries into the capital, and he promised the praetorian guards, we will not punish you for selling the throne to this guy Julius if you murder him and join our army. So they went right into the Senate. They proclaimed Septimius Severus was the emperor. Julius was arrested and beheaded, and Severus marched in a great hero, and he became the Roman emperor. Julius only reigned for 6 months, and he died. So, you know, we could tell you other stories, but you get the idea here. This is a dangerous job. They were murdered, assassinated, over and over and over again. Another thing that pertains to persecution is the catacombs. The catacombs. The catacombs are systems of underground passages used as burial places in the city of Rome. They are systems of underground passages. In other words, they're tunnels and rooms under Rome. In ancient Rome, they were used as burial places. The most famous catacombs are right outside the city of Rome. The early Christians added to the catacombs. cutting them into the soft tufa rock in the 200s and 300s. The catacombs formed a network of connecting corridors and rooms covering over 600 acres in size. Graves were cut into the walls. Bricks or marble slabs were used to close some of the graves. When more space was needed, additional galleries or halls were dug beneath the first ones. Christians used these catacombs to hide in and for funeral and memorial services during persecutions. They painted Christian fresco paintings on the walls. Two things that are interesting in the catacombs are, number one, praying figures of dead resurrected saints standing with their arms upraised, praising God in adoration. Now, this is interesting because it shows a Christian in the 200s praying this way. And they had pictures of him doing that. Now, this is what 1 Timothy 2:8 teaches, that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands. And so we see a confirmation of the New Testament doctrine right in the catacombs painted on the walls. They lifted their hands in prayer, just like modern Pentecostals do. The second doctrinal item is that baptistries were carved deep enough for immersion. And these still exist today. And so we find in the catacombs today baptistries, which shows they practiced baptism by immersion, even in the 200s and the 300s, in time of persecution. During persecution, Christians took refuge in these catacombs because Roman law held all burial places were sacred. And so they could hide there and the army wouldn't enter. The catacombs lost their usefulness when Christianity became the established religion of the empire following the Edict of Milan. And the existence of these catacombs was completely forgotten after about AD 400. For over 1,000 years, no one knew they were there. They were finally rediscovered in 1578. And when they were found, it was thought they were the ruins of ancient cities. So, we find evidence of two early Christian doctrine and practices, lifting hands in prayer and baptism by immersion. Now, they also used the catacombs to get sand for cement and building stone and mortar. Some of the tunnels are natural. Most of them were dug. There are innumerable entrances, corners, passages, dead ends. It's like a maze under there. And only the Christians knew the way. They're cold and they're damp. Historians say that Christians sent boys up to the surface to hunt for food at night. They also got food from Christians who were living on the top. And you see the ministry of the body of Christ there. Some on the top feeding those who lived underground. They used boys because boys are not under suspicion. We don't do this anymore, but, you know, I read all the Sherlock Holmes books before we had Deliverance and got rid of all that kind of stuff. And he always did that, you know. Anybody read any of those stories? He always used little boys and he used them to go run around and do things because they could stand there and listen to conversations and deliver messages and things, and they're above suspicion. And if somebody turns, a little boy runs away. That doesn't mean anything. His little boy will run away anyway. Some Christians lived their whole lives there. They were born, lived there, and died there. They were used most under the persecution of Decius and Diocletian. But Christians had used it from the time of Domitian. These vast subterranean galleries are commonly 8 to 10 feet wide, 4 to 6 feet high. They extend for hundreds of miles under the city of Rome. Christian graves are variously estimated between 2 million and 7 million. There are more than 4,000 inscriptions found belonging to the period between Tiberius and Constantine, which would be the New Testament times from, say, AD 37 to AD 300, 313 or 325, right in there. So, we don't know how many martyrs there were in Rome. No one knows for sure. The Christian graves are estimated between 2 and 7 million. Not all of those are persecution deaths, though. Some are people who just lived and died there. What do we know about the extent of Christianity, though? Well, here are the few facts that I've been able to find. In the time of Nero, it was stated there were about 7,000 Christians in Rome. I did read you from that letter of Pliny to Trajan. That's about 110 now, another 50 years later, when he lamented that the pagan temples were virtually deserted and the sacred sacrifice animals had no purchasers, and the sect of Christianity was not only in the cities but in the villages and open country. In the middle of the 3rd century, this would be the 200s, historians say there were about 50,000 Christians in Rome, the city of Rome I'm talking about. And the city had a population of about 1 million. So that's 50,000 people out of 1 million people, which is 5% or 1/20. By about 300, Christianity had invaded every land, town, hamlet. Maximian said in one of his edicts, quote, almost all, close quote, had abandoned the worship of their ancestors for the new sect. In the 200s and 300s, the population of the whole Roman Empire is estimated at 10 million, and it is estimated there were 1 million Christians, so that's 1/10. Some historians estimate that even up to 1/2 of the people are Christians. That would be 5 million out of 10 million. That's still during the time of persecution. So undoubtedly, millions of Christians died in these persecutions. We're certain it's over 1 million. As noted in the catacombs, there's 2 to 7 million graves. So 2 million is a conservative figure. It goes as high as 7 million. After the Edict of Milan in 313, by about 380 under Theodosius, Christianity was very widespread and very popular. For example, the church at Antioch had 100,000 members. Now this is Syrian Antioch. Remember I said there's two Antiochs and we need to distinguish these from each other. Talking about this Antioch. When it says in Acts 13, now in the church that was in Antioch, there were certain prophets and teachers, and they set out Barnabas and Saul. It means this church. It was a huge assembly. Here's the other Antioch. It's in Pisidia in Asia Minor, but we don't worry about that one. This is the big one here. Syrian Antioch. So they had 100,000 members in the church, and a city had a population of 500,000. So that's one in every five people was a member of the Christian church. The historians say there were 3,000 paid workers in the church at Antioch. Chrysostom said there were more Christians than pagans and Jews in Antioch. But his count includes everyone, slaves, babies, visitors, and everybody. Now, in the 4th century, there are 5 great centers of Christianity. I want you to memorize these. They are, number 1, Alexandria, Egypt. Number 2, Jerusalem, Israel. Number 3, Antioch, Syria. Number 4, Constantinople, in Asia. And you'll notice all 4 of those are in the eastern half of the empire. And then Rome, Italy, the only major center in the west. Alexandria, Jerusalem, Antioch, Constantinople, and Rome. The majority of Christians lived in the eastern half of the empire, not the western half of the empire. This is in the 300s, in the 4th century. There are 5 great centers of Christianity. Let me talk about the Roman Empire a little bit itself. The Roman Empire was really a wonderful thing in some ways. It had near world dominion in its time. It had a huge army and a huge navy. And of course it had a system of roads. Some of those Roman roads still exist and are still used without many repairs. Now you know what our roads are like. They put asphalt down in 1982, and by 1986 it's full of potholes and wreck. They have Roman roads that have been used for 2,000 years. I've seen films of them, and now they aren't big roads that cars drive on, but they're roads that carts and animals and people walk on for hundreds of miles, and they still exist. They also had a system of... Now, these roads were made for the military. In fact, this handout here, File 52 on Rome, if you read the handout, it talks about the system of Roman roads. Let's see. Let's see what it says about it. Well, I don't see the statement on it, but they built the system of roads through the whole empire in order to easily march their army to different sectors. But these were used to... here it is. Rome used both military and political methods to gain and maintain power. To hold conquered territory, the Romans built excellent roads and frontier military outposts called colonies. And so the Romans built roads for military reasons, but they were used for commerce, and it was one of the greatest features of Rome to have this huge system of roads that had never existed in the world before, all over the empire. They also had theaters, aqueducts, baths, stadiums, huge libraries, large government buildings. They had Roman law and Roman court, which was democratic. They had canals. They had commerce and travel. They had vacations. They had holidays and circuses. Industry flourished. There was a very large book trade in the city of Rome. Stores and libraries were crowded. In fact, in the 4th century, there were 28 public libraries in Rome. That's more than the city of Seattle has. They also had... The reason they had this is because they had a huge slave labor trade of scribes. And they would fill a room with 200 or 300 scribes, all having manuscripts and ink, and they would have one reader. And all the scribes would copy that book so they could make 200 or 300 copies of a book at one time. But there are a lot of errors in hand copying. They had games and festivals and laughter and parades and honors and wealth. The Roman citizens themselves did not pay taxes. Only those conquered subjects that were not citizens paid taxes. So you can see all the people in Rome were living high off money imported into the city from other parts of the empire at the bequest of the armies and Caesar. One writer said they had 150 holidays a year. Now that's a lot. That's almost one every 3 or 4 days. So it was a glorious thing. They also did shows that have not been duplicated in modern times. For example, in the circus, it was watertight. And they were able to flood this dirt floor place until it was 6 foot high of water and have ship battles in there. And they performed these things for people, for entertainment. And then they would drain the water out and use it for other things. Now, we don't do that today. They also had shows where the Roman army used their shields above their head, large brass shields. And they had horse shows on top of the shields as they marched down the road. Now imagine that. a big army with all these shields, and they're marching down the road, and there's horses riding on top, and they have a horse show up there. Incredible thing. Now, on the other hand, Rome was base, because the majority of the population through the empire lived in poverty. We're talking about the city of Rome. Most people were slaves, peasants, poor, brutalized, and stomped upon by the rough Romans. The gladiatorial shows in the city of Rome were also brutal and bloodthirsty. They had wars on their borders continually. There were always wars between the Roman armies and the emperor, as one general would overthrow the emperor and he'd become emperor. Of course, there's the persecution against Christians, that's base, where they were hunted down and tortured. And there were excesses among the wealthy. Historians say sometimes they had feasts that lasted hours and hours and hours. People became fat. They ate all kinds of sumptuous foods, many different types of meats, vegetables, breads, desserts, and beverages, and then they would have slaves jump on their stomachs, and they would vomit and then re-eat again. For days, they would have these feasts. They brought in foods from all over the world. One of the items of snobbery in their day was dissolving pearls in wine. And so they imported wines from all over the world and put pearls in them and had glasses all over their homes. And it was a big deal to do that. You know, it's like today there are certain things people do, you know, like they own a BMW or they have, I don't even know what they all are, but you know, that kind of stuff. You have a certain type of wristwatch or you drink a certain kind of wine or you have Seahawks tickets for the season, you know, and that kind of stuff. Well, they had those things, too, for their society. A lot of people in Rome were alcoholics. Adultery and fornication and divorce was rampant. Many men in Rome were homosexuals. And this is why Paul wrote that passage on homosexuality in the book of Romans. That's Romans 1, 26 and 27. It says, "For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature." So this is a woman homosexual or a lesbian. "And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men, working that which is unseemly." Now listen to this. "And receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet." Or fair. And you know that happens to a homosexual? If they do those things, the Bible says they receive in themselves the recompense or repayment for that error. That's fair. And that's the truth. They get diseases in their body. They get demons in them. They get psychological problems. They receive in their body, soul, and spirit all kinds of terrible things from doing that. Just like God said. By the way, the Bible says, "Those which commit such things are worthy of death." Romans 1:32. And that's in the New Testament. Some Christians have said, well, the New Testament doesn't teach capital punishment. It does right there. Romans 1:32. And it teaches capital punishment for homosexuality. Right there. It said, I'll read it. "They which commit such things are worthy of death," quote unquote. That's what God said about it. "They also did wicked things for pleasure." Some Romans took people and put them in strangely shaped vases. And they fed them starchy diets, and their bodies conformed to the shape of the vase. And they grew people in vases. And then at parties, they broke the vase and made sport of these people and laughed at them. Now I say, God in heaven sees that type of brutality and gross, wicked, indescribably grisly behavior. And they're going to burn in hell for doing such things to anyone. Okay, well, we'll stop here. That's probably one of the worst things ever came across, you know. You'd have to be demonically inspired to do that.